Welcome to the Skeptic's Guide to Emergency Medicine. Meet him, greet him, treat him, and street him. Today's date is October 30th, 2019, and I am your skeptical host, Ken Milne. The title of today's podcast is Edoxaban for Cancer-Associated VTE. Would I lie to you, or would the New England Journal of Medicine lie to you? And our guest skeptic is Dr. Anand Swaminathan. Swami is an assistant professor of emergency medicine at the St. Joseph's Regional Medical Center in Paterson, New Jersey. He is a deputy editor of EMRAP and associate editor for Rebel EM. Welcome back to the SGM, Swami. It has been way too long.
It really has been way too long, Ken. I can't even remember the last time that I was on here. I am so excited to do this again because, Ken, this is one of my favorite things to do. I love taking an article apart, and I love doing it with the skeptic.
Well, before we get too into this, with regards to the theme music, and if the New England Journal of Medicine is listening, which I don't suspect they are, but if they are, we're not saying you're lying. What we are saying is you need to be skeptical of anything that is published, even if it's published in the New England Journal of Medicine. This is because we think the peer review process was not strong in this case and resulted in a misleading article.
I agree, Ken. I've noticed this recently as a trend among big journals, especially in the New England Journal of Medicine, where you read something and you think, you know, I feel like the peer reviewers should have been a little harsher here. There's a lot of phase two studies getting published in the New England Journal of Medicine, a lot of small trials, a lot of pilots, and it doesn't really make sense to me. And we're going to get into this particular one because, Ken, this is an article that has the potential to greatly shift the way that we treat a specific disorder.
It does. So we'll run through all of those things. But before that happens, what's new in the world of Swami these days? Because I noticed you've moved institutions.
Yeah. So I was for 13 years at the same place at Bellevue and NYU. And I love that place. They trained me well, I think. And it was time to go. It was time to move because I wanted to be a little closer to my family, have a little shorter commute, take on some new challenges. So now I'm in Paterson, New Jersey, which is in northern Jersey. It is a inner city population, a huge volume of patients, really sick, and it's exactly what I wanted. I don't want my patients to be sick, Ken, but when they're sick, I want to be the one that's there to take care of them. So I'm very happy to join the faculty there. It's a fantastic place, some great people, and I'm really excited that they took me in. And I am really looking forward to hopefully the rest of my career in one place.
Well, even though we haven't physically been together, I saw that you presented at the Female Idea Exchange 2018, or FIX 18. Any thoughts or highlights, comments from the experience?
Oh, there were so many, Ken. It's really an amazing conference. It's one that's unlike any other I've ever been to. It's a really inspiring place to be, to listen to these people's stories. And I did get to kind of chime in with a little bit of my background and choices that I've made and how to be a supportive partner in a relationship. But it was really, for me, learning from everybody else and also catching up with a bunch of our good friends, Derek Cass, Jenny Beck Esme, Natalie May, so many good friends that I was able to catch up with and listen to and hear what they had to say.
Well, I have to say, I am planning on attending FIX 19 that will be in New York City next year. You better save the date. It's September 15th to 17th, 2019.
And I'll tell you, Ken, that those tickets will go extremely fast as they did this time. So if you have any interest in this, and you really should, it is really not just for women. It is for every healthcare professional and probably for a lot of people outside of the field of healthcare profession as well. Get those tickets as soon as they come out because they do go fast.
Well, this is not the Swami and Ken show. This is the Skeptic's Guide to Emergency Medicine, so you better give me a case.
Absolutely. A 43-year-old woman with a history of breast cancer currently undergoing chemotherapy presents with mild chest pain. She's hemodynamically stable except for a heart rate of 105, and her pain is increased with taking a deep breath. The chest x-ray is unremarkable. You order a CT pulmonary angiogram, which demonstrates a right segmental pulmonary embolism. You write a prescription for low molecular weight heparin and advise the patient that she's going to be taking shots for a couple of months. She tells you that a friend of hers had a clot in her leg and was given an oral blood thinner. She wants to know if you could prescribe that pill so she doesn't have to take the shot.
Venous thromboembolism occurs frequently in patients with cancer. Treatment in this group entails a number of challenges, including a higher rate of thrombosis recurrence and a higher risk of bleeding. Standard therapy at this time for both symptomatic and asymptomatic VTE is low molecular weight heparin based on results from the clot trial.
In non-cancer patients, the NOACs, the new oral anticoagulants like rivaroxaban, have been shown to be effective in treatment without increasing bleeding events. The NOACs are easier to use for patients than getting a shot, so we like to do that where it's possible.
And Swami, how long do we have to call them the NOACs, the new oral anticoagulants? Do we have to wait for a new kid to come on the block before we just start saying DOACs and direct oral anticoagulants?
Yeah, then we would have the new oral anticoagulants, the NOACs, like the high sensitivity troponin or the high sensitivity troponin.
So we'll go the gold standard and then the platinum standard and then the ludicrous standard.
It's perfect. That's exactly the way to do it.
Spaceballs. It all comes back to Spaceballs. Well, we covered using rivaroxaban on SGEM 126 with VTE guru Dr. Jeff Klein. This study suggested it was safe and effective to dry start. That means no low molecular weight heparin needed in certain patients with DVTs and PEs.
So though these agents are frequently used in treatment of cancer-associated VTE as well, there's a dearth of evidence supporting this practice. In fact, none of the major agents, and we're talking about dabigatran, rivaroxaban, apixaban, or edoxaban, have undergone a well-done randomized clinical trial.
Until now, give us the clinical question.
Is edoxaban non-inferior to low molecular weight heparin in the treatment of cancer-associated VTE?
And the reference?
This is by Raskob et al., edoxaban for the treatment of cancer-associated venous thromboembolism, New England Journal of Medicine, 2018.
You know the drill. We're going to do the PICO. What was the population?
So this was all adult patients with active cancer or cancer diagnosed within the previous 2 years with acute symptomatic or asymptomatic deep vein thrombosis, DVT, or pulmonary embolism, PE.
And I'll put a link in for the list of all the exclusions. How about the intervention?
Low molecular weight heparin for 5 days, followed by oral edoxaban, 60 milligrams daily for at least 6 months.
And what did they compare it to?
So it's compared to subcutaneous dalteparin, 200 IUs per kilo daily. The maximum dose was 18,000 international units for 1 month, followed by 150 international units per kilo daily for at least 5 more months.
And let's run through the outcomes. What was the primary outcome?
So the primary outcome was a composite of recurrent VTE, that was DVT, or segmental or more proximal PE, or major bleeding. Overt bleeding associated with a 2 gram per deciliter drop in hemoglobin or a transfusion or 2 or more units of blood during 12-month follow-up.
And how about their secondary outcomes?
There were a number of secondary outcomes, and we'll list those in the show notes, but the important ones were clinically relevant non-major bleeding, event-free survival, VTE-related death, all-cause mortality. We like that one, Ken. That's a good one to look at. Recurrent DVT, recurrent PE, and again, the complete list will be in the show notes.
And the author's conclusions were, quote, oral edoxaban was non-inferior to subcutaneous dalteparin with respect to the composite outcome of recurrent venous thromboembolism or major bleeding. The rate of recurrent venous thromboembolism was lower, but the rate of major bleeding was higher with edoxaban than with dalteparin. End of quote. All right, let's go through the quality checklist for an RCT. Are these emergency patients?
Unsure. It doesn't really say in the manuscript, but my guess is that most of these patients are in the outpatient setting.
And were they adequately randomized?
Yep, they were randomized 1-to-1 using a web-based system.
And did they conceal the randomization?
No. The patients and providers were unblinded. There's no specification of whether the outcome assessors were blinded or not. And that typically means that they weren't. If they were blinded, that's something you really want to point out. And that's a big problem because they could easily have been blinded.
And the patients, were they analyzed in the groups to which they were randomized?
They were. They did a modified intention to treat analysis. Patients were included in the groups they were randomized to as long as they received at least 1 dose of the assigned medication.
Were they recruited consecutively?
It's unsure. It was not mentioned in the manuscript. Again, this typically means that they probably weren't recruited consecutively.
And when you looked at both groups, were they similar with respect to prognostic factors?
They were.
Now, were the participants unaware of their group allocation?
No, they weren't. All participants were aware of which group they were in. However, those adjudicating severity of major bleeding were unaware of the treatment assignment.
And were groups treated equally except for the intervention?
No. Different cancers were treated differently. So this was an amalgam of different types of cancer. Additionally, patients were stratified by bleeding risk based on type of cancer and stage.
And was the follow-up complete?
Yes, it was.
All patient important outcomes, were they considered?
I think so. I think the big ones that we care about were all considered.
And the last question, question number 11, the treatment effect, was it large enough and precise enough to be clinically significant?
Unsure. And we're going to come back to this as we get a little nerdy later on.
Ooh, love talking nerdy with you, Swami. Okay, well, this trial included just over 1,000 patients with an average age in the early 60s, and it was a close to a 50-50 male-female split. More than 50% had metastatic disease, with almost a third with recurrent disease. But what was the key result?
The key result was that edoxaban was non-inferior to dalteparin for the primary outcome of recurrent VTE or major bleeding.
Yeah, it was 12.8% versus 13.5%, which gives you a hazard ratio of 0.97, and the 95% confidence interval went from 0.7 to 1.36, with a p-value of 0.006 for non-inferiority. We'll list all the secondary outcomes in the show notes, but I want to get to that nerdy section. And there were so many little EBM nuggets in this paper. That fact makes me want to double my number of nerdy points from 5 to 10.
I don't think we have a choice, Ken, especially since you haven't had me on the show in such a long time. I feel like I've saved up my nerdiness just for this.
Oh, perfect. Well, I'll lead it off with the consecutive patients. You already talked about this in the checklist. There is no mention in the manuscript if there were consecutive patients enrolled in the trial. Selection bias could have been introduced, making the results harder to interpret. However, when you go to the supplemental index, it says, quote, adult subjects presenting with VTE associated with cancer for whom long-term treatment with low molecular weight heparin is intended are eligible to participate in the study. It doesn't say, quote, all, so we're unsure.
Emergency patients. So this was one of the questions we asked is, does this apply to the emergency department? It appears these patients were recruited from outpatient clinics, again, not specified. Could this protocol be applied to the emergency department? That's a question that it's hard to answer. So we don't know if this really applies to what we do. And in general, Ken, when I have a patient like this, I usually call the oncologist and come up with a plan together. So I don't know that we can institute this on our own. But again, we just don't know exactly how this applies to our patients that we see.
Yeah, I do the same thing. I often call up the oncologist and say, hey, we've got this patient here. How should we put this together with taking into the patient's values and preferences and adding my clinical judgment, but also their clinical judgment and expertise into it and then reflecting upon the literature?
Absolutely.
The third point, though, was about lack of blinding. These patients were not blinded, while the outcome assessors for major bleeding were unaware of group assignment. It is unsure if patients knowing what group they were assigned to would have impacted the results. Why not just have placebo pills and sub-Q injections? This could have minimized this form of bias.
Our number four point is the combined endpoint. Now, Ken, I know you want to say it.
There can be only one.
There can only be one primary outcome. And there was only one primary outcome. It just happened to be a composite of two other primary outcomes. They kind of navigated around that one. But the two things they looked at for their composite was VTE recurrence and safety of major bleeding. Now, why not just look at one of those? Why not just look at VTE recurrence? And usually that's what we would do. We would see VTE recurrence as the primary and the safety endpoint would be completely separate. So they could have asked that. They could have even asked the patients, what is the most important thing for us to look at? I think that why they did this, and we'll get back to this in a little bit, is because combining them is what gave the non-inferiority. On their own, you would have seen the major bleeding sticking out as, hey, more patients in the group that got edoxaban bled, even though we had a lower VTE rate. So again, I think this is an important thing to look at, and it's unclear exactly why they did it, unless there was a bit of a nefarious bend to this.
Well, the fifth point is about patient-oriented primary outcome, and we can drill down into that idea of a patient-oriented primary outcome. There was a lower VTE rate with edoxaban, but a higher major bleed rate. This did not translate into a statistical difference in all-cause mortality or event-free survival. So ultimately, what is more important to patients?
Point number six is the changed primary endpoint. If you go to clinicaltrials.gov, you can see that they originally had co-primary outcomes. The primary efficacy outcome was the incidence of recurrent VTE, and the primary safety outcome was clinically relevant bleeding while on treatment. So this goes back to the point that we made before. They combined these two, even though that's not what they initially set out to do. So this was changed to the adjudicated recurrent VTE or major bleeding event as a combined primary outcome.
Well, in addition, Swami, the original recurrent VTE time frame was 6 months. This was extended to 12 months. The original primary outcome at 6 months can be found in the supplementary index, and it showed non-inferiority of edoxaban compared to dalteparin for recurrent VTE, but an increased hazard ratio for clinically relevant bleeds. And this was major or clinically relevant non-major bleeding. There was no difference in all-cause mortality or event-free survival. And I'll put a table into the show notes.
Again, if we search through the clinicaltrials.gov site and we look at where this time frame changed, it looks like that change was only introduced in September of 2018. This is 4 years after the study began and on the day the results were first reported. It's unusual to see a combination of efficacy and safety as the primary outcome, and given that we don't know why the authors changed this, it almost seems like the reason was they were trying to hide that increased risk of bleeding. Now, personally, Ken, I am more concerned about major bleeding in my patients than I am about recurrent VTE, because recurrent VTE is a very common and almost expected thing to see in patients with cancer who have a first VTE.
Yeah, and we're trying to be careful, I think, here, Swami, from being skeptics and not drifting off into conspiracy theories.
I'll rein it in a little bit.
All right, and the seventh point is about cost. There was no mention of cost between oral edoxaban versus sub-Q dalteparin. This was a multinational trial done in 12 different countries. Funding for medication is done differently from country to country. This issue may come into play when thinking about applying these results. I did a quick search of goodrx.com, and it showed edoxaban 60 milligrams cost $4,200 for a one-year supply. Well, if you looked at dalteparin sub-Q, would cost $36,800.
And that doesn't really take into account, Ken, the fact that that's just the cost for the drug. We may, in some patients, have to also have the cost of a nurse to administer it, depending on whether that patient can do that on their own. So there's a considerable difference in those two costs. Point number eight is about non-inferiority. So this was a non-inferiority trial design. They wanted to demonstrate that oral edoxaban was no worse than dalteparin in the parameters they measured. But what about patient satisfaction? They didn't ask patients if they were happy with their care and if they would have liked to have been randomized into the other group. Was avoiding needles important to most of the patients? In the real-world application, would it mean more nursing visits or forgetting those sub-Q injections and less with the oral medications? Would patients value that RN visit for other reasons aside from just the needle being given? These are all things to consider when contemplating how to apply these results. Now, all of that being said, compliance with the regimen suggests that patients did prefer the pills to the shots.
The ninth point is about conflicts of interest. The authors reported multiple conflicts of interest. The lead author and the senior author both disclosed getting consultant fees and honorarium from the company that manufactured this drug. This does not make the data wrong, but it should make us more skeptical.
And then finally, our nerdy point number 10 is about sponsorship. It relates a little bit to number 9. This trial was sponsored by the pharmaceutical manufacturer of edoxaban. Now, this too doesn't make the data wrong, but we do have to be a little more skeptical. This pharmaceutical company, in collaboration with the coordinating committee, was responsible for the trial design, protocol, and oversight. They were responsible for collection of the data and maintenance of the data. They also performed all the statistical analysis in collaboration with the writing committee. All of these things raise a little bit of concerns for me. I would rather that the sponsor says, hey, we want to support you doing it, but then let the researchers do it independently.
I agree. Well, let's comment on the author's conclusions and compare them to the SGEM's conclusion.
So I think that we would reverse the way that these conclusions were emphasized based on the first do no harm principle. We also have used the original co-primary outcome at 6 months rather than the changed composite outcome at 12 months. Our conclusion would have been that oral edoxaban had a higher rate of clinically relevant bleeding compared to dalteparin. It was non-inferior with respect to recurrent VTE, and there was no statistically significant difference observed in all-cause mortality and event-free survival.
Well, then you're going to have to give us a bottom line.
Here's our bottom line. Oral edoxaban may be a reasonable option to discuss with patients who have a cancer-associated VTE, but the decision should probably be left up to the patient and their oncologist.
How about a case resolution?
This patient was given low molecular weight heparin as usual and referred back to her oncologist to discuss the possibility of going on an oral agent for continued management.
And how are you going to take this information and apply it clinically?
The evidence for using edoxaban or any other DOAC in cancer-associated VTE is inconclusive. Though some of these agents are being preferentially used for treatment, we eagerly await further studies on the topic to determine if there's a most appropriate regimen. Consideration of a DOAC on an individual patient basis is reasonable, particularly if compliance and cost is going to be an issue, and it should be done in concert with the patient's oncologist.
So how are you going to talk to the patient then?
I understand why you might want a pill instead of a shot. A recent medical study shows that a pill was not inferior to a shot for preventing future blood clots. However, it did cause more bleeding. All the patients in the study got a shot once a day for at least 5 days before starting the pill. This option is something you can talk about with your oncologist next week, especially because you'll have a little bit of information of how you're dealing with those shots. And in the meantime, I'll also send your oncologist a note letting them know what we've done and what we recommend for the future.
Okay, it's time for the Keener Contest. Last week's winner was Aaron Morgan, a PGY1 emergency medicine resident. He knew the tusk of a narwhal was sometimes sold as a unicorn horn. What's the question this week?
The first factor Xa inhibitor was isolated in 1987 as a naturally occurring compound named antistatin. It was isolated from the salivary glands of what animal?
Ooh, if you know the answer, then send an email to thesgem@gmail.com with Keener in the subject line. The first correct answer will receive a cool skeptical prize. There are some other FOMED resources on this issue, and I'll list them in the show notes. But Swami, it is great to have you back on the SGEM talking nerdy.
Absolutely, and I can't wait to do it again.
So Swami, when shall we meet again?
I don't know, Ken. I hope it's coming soon. We'll definitely be at Fix 19 together, so maybe that's going to be the next time, but I hope that we will have a chance earlier than that.
Well, until then, can you use that awesome voice of yours to give the SGEM tagline?
Remember to be skeptical of anything you learn, even if you heard it on The Skeptic's Guide to Emergency Medicine.
Talk to everyone next week.